Okay, and welcome back. It is becoming an annual pleasure to spend time with John Hogue. We've done this for a number of years now. John, of course, the world's foremost scholar, researcher, analyst, and just general authority on Nostradamus, and much more than all that. He has 9 books, over 1 million in print now in 17 languages. He calls himself at times a rogue scholar, but he is truly a world authority on Nostradamus, and it's always a pleasure to have him on the program, find out what he has to say about the coming year. And I kind of was almost tempted, John, to go listen to last year's program to see how right you were, but I'll let you kind of sum that up for us. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Jeff. Yes, I am at the moment for the show putting the final touches on a reassessment of my 2006 predictions, which I published for my free newsletter, HogueProphecy.com, back on 31st of December last year.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, the year before, actually. And as I was looking through it, I was also trying to set up all the quotes that I have about Iraq since 2 years before the war happened to make an assessment. I suppose
it goes back 5 years.
Yeah, my first predictions about if Bush were elected president, that he would, in the middle of his first term, take us into war in the Middle East, most likely Iraq. It would depose Saddam Hussein. It would be an easy invasion, which would lead to a quagmire second Vietnam. That's what I said 2 years before, even before he was president. So in the process...
You mean 1998?
No, I said it in 2000.
So 2002, okay, I got you.
Sorry, 2 years, I made that a little unclear. 2 years into his presidency, I predicted he would do this, and I made that prediction before he was president.
Got it.
And starting in October and November, when there was the dispute in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have been feeling a strong need to assess the last 6 years of Hogue Prophecy Bulletin quotes, which document my predictions, mainly because we, with the 2007, are entering a very, very significant margin, a border, a cusp, if you will, between two ages.
Mm-hmm.
The Piscean Age is coming to an end, and now we'll begin to feel the influences of the next 2,000-year age, the Aquarian Age. And the immediate influences we will feel in the death and rebirth of ages is the travail, the cramps of the pregnancy, the death of what we know, the cracking of the seed for the flowering to come out.
The menopause of a passing millennium.
Yes.
That wasn't bad, was it?
I don't know quite what it was, but it's an interesting phrase.
Thank you.
It is a death and a rebirth, and there's pain involved in it. Let us face it, ladies and gentlemen. There is we can't avoid. So let us look at it straight in the face,
yeah,
and embrace this as a challenge. Because I tell you, the next this border, this margin in time, lasts 2 years.
So 7 and 8 are going to be.
They are very significant.
Yeah.
They are the anvil of history. They are the time when, in the very least, decisions will be made which will be reaped after the 36 years of decisions that happened before. You see, there's this little rhythm in history that's called the cosmic calendar, which I've spoken on the show before about. And
yeah,
it's far more significant than the 2012 Mayan calendar, which is completely
Thank
overlooked.
You.
Yeah,
that
most of that is just a lot of hype.
It's a marketer's dream is what it is.
Yeah. And it's also far enough away that people can market it for all kinds of well-meaning but unconscious and directly cynical reasons. I think the people who are into it, who have created it, are sincere, but it's really a classic example of projection as prophecy. The thing that's far more significant is what we've entered right now, and that is a 36-year rhythm in history, which essentially is the in the cosmic calendar, which is the time it takes for the vernal equinox to retrograde through all 12 tropical signs of zodiac, which means in layman's term, the position of the spring equinox takes roughly in normal years 25,700 plus years, normal years, to go all the way around in one circle. So that's called the cosmic year. A month is about 2,000 years long. So the age of Pisces is a month, and the age of Aquarius is the new month we're entering now.
Okay, question, quick question.
Well, just to finish the background for all this, is the cosmic day is defined by 72 normal years divided into two 36-year units. One is the day. The sower, the husbander, and the other 36 years is the night, that is the reaper. We are, since 1972-73, when we changed over, decisions that happened in 72-73 had a lot to do with how our history has been going. It's where Arab terrorism began, global oil focus, all of that started. A lot of good things, too, the interest, the shift in consciousness, people experimenting with new religious ideas, meditation, things like this also started there. Watergate also started then. Our disassociation with our government as a people started then. So all of that was sown in the last 36 years, good and bad, and now we have entered the beginning of cosmic night, the feminine, the reaping, the harvest. And so now we're in a 36-year period of harvesting the karma, good and bad, of the things that we started in the last 36 years.
Yeah.
So how we, to finish off, how we embrace what we harvest, how we accept what's going on is very, very important for the individual as well as for the nation and world.
Indeed. How we carry our burden. The question I had was to do with the age of Pisces. Now, Pisces, in a rudimentary sense, is commonly associated with, is erratic, flighty,
inconsistent,
irrational. Those are all appropriate descriptors, I guess, to one degree or another.
Now, mystical.
There you go. Would that then translate to the end, as the shift kind of rumbles into place, would some of those characteristics perhaps even be more intense and fleeting at the same time? It's not a smooth mesh. It's kind of a two gears clunking together.
And now I finally found the voice to respond to your menopause of age, because that is it. It's that what happens when an age gets old is similar to a human being who has not accepted, who is living in a dream of what they would like things to be, and not embracing the challenge of a chapter in life which says now you're reaching a point where the visitation on the planet or your reality is now going to change in some mysterious death and rebirth experience. Most people in their conditioning, as well as it abstractly speaking, an age, which is the collective conditioning when it reaches its old age, does not want to give up its usurpation of things. It resists. It undermines it because it cannot understand the new era that's coming. It tends to look back into the past for solutions to a world it doesn't understand, a new world, a new era that is now going to come at us full time in the coming 2 years. So yes, the collision between the old humanity not wanting to embrace or even accept the reality of change, that their end is coming, cannot see in the greater sense of thing that the end of an old idea is also liberating to them in the rebirth in a new consciousness. People who want to hold on, all of us have this in us, want to hold on to the past or to what we know, are going to find it very difficult to deal with the changes coming.
Old dogs don't learn new tricks.
And especially if at a certain point, unless they find in this crisis a consciousness that becomes awakened from crisis, that realizes that the idea that I was a bulldog is something somebody else programmed onto me, to keep me down. When I see that is the reality, then I'm no longer that bulldog who can't learn new tricks.
Very good. Well, we better send a copy of this program to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue as he's plotting his surge into Baghdad with 20 or 30,000 more Americans.
Very bulldoggish.
Boys and girls. Yep. Brick-brained, bulldoggish, whatever you want to call it. All right, come back in just a minute. John Hogue and I will continue with John's look forward to 2007. We'll get his thoughts on the murder of Saddam Hussein and many other things, not to mention the murder of nearly 700,000 Iraqis by the criminal-in-chief in the White House since he invaded that country. Back in a few minutes. People of all goodwill and reasonable mental faculties around the world watched the charade trial of Saddam Hussein, the duly elected president of a Middle East country. Three of his attorneys were murdered during the proceedings. The judge was removed at the last minute after proclaiming that Saddam was not a dictator. The man was killed by his enemies. It's all going into a state of utter chaos. It's beyond fragmentation now. But of course we think that this is by design, and the perpetrators of this rape of a nation, this despoiling, this disemboweling of a country, which had a history going back as far as any country calling itself the Holy Land, and maybe even then some. But John, what are your thoughts on Iraq and Hussein in particular?
For over almost 20 years now, just under 20 years, I have been writing in my last 9 books off and on about a figure that I always considered the top candidate for Nostradamus' third Antichrist, Mabus. It was the term that he uses, which in reverse lettering is Subam, Sudan, Saddam, Saddam, in the phonetic spelling from Roman letters. If people want to see how that crunches out in other candidates, they can look at HogueProphecy.com and see many articles where I describe about the process.
He's not the only candidate for that title.
Oh, no. And for a long, long time, he seemed to be the only candidate. And then after 9/11, he was kind of pushed back in line by Osama bin Laden and people like Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Musab is Mabus spelled in a different way. Usama bin Laden is M-A-A-U-S with the B from bin Laden replacing the one redundant A, gives you Mabus, classic anagram games.
Sure.
And of course one of the most controversial, most people in the West nod in agreement when I say this, and then they get upset when I say the other chief candidate is George W. Bush, which you do in anagrams lowercase lettering. You don't use capital letters. And the idea is that back in the time Nostradamus was producing these things in the 16th century, a lot of typeface was actually used because they ran out of typeface when printing books. So an O could be used in the case of a U.
Oh, yeah.
An R upside down is an L.
Mm-hmm.
And so one has to take into consideration these things.
Mm.
In the case of for instance, Bush, is that you have in lowercase the GW, in lowercase, turned 190 degrees on our heads to the left, make M-A, little M-A. With B-U-S and the silent H, you have a classic anagram for MABA out of George W. Bush. So these candidates have been there. What's important about the prophecy, the two prophecies that describe this character, is it's not clear whether he is, in the two prophecies, a single man or a man who's victimized by the third Antichrist, or one and the same. But what is clear in both prophecies is that before a 27-year war can happen, the world war that this man launches, he's one of the first to fall. He is destroyed. He's annihilated. He's murdered. And it is the death of the man that mm-hmm. triggers the mm-hmm. martyrdom, that triggers the rush to war. Or his death or martyrdom is the thing that is a milestone dating the beginning of the war.
But he in and of himself might not be the guy who pulls the trigger.
This is what is he's the target, at least.
Many people misunderstand that, John. Let me make that clear. They think that Mabus is the bad guy, is the George Bush, is the guy who causes the things to happen, and not necessarily. So he could be a tangential player, like Saddam Hussein at this point, was basically politically irrelevant from the day he was deposed.
Well, he was a tool of forces.
Right.
You know, one of the reasons why Saddam Hussein had such a long, successful dictatorship is because U.S. governments in the past had given him the wherewithal to make the weapons of mass destruction.
They created the man and propped him up and had him fight a 10-year war.
So
and on and on. And
so,
but may I say one other thing just keep the book clean on this? Saddam Hussein was formally charged with and convicted of crimes against humanity, i.e., the killing of 140 some odd Kurds with gas.
Yeah.
Now, there is one small problem with that, and it's a fairly substantial problem. The New York Times reported this, but no one else did. They did an interview at some length with a man named Pelletier, or Pelletier. He just happened to be the CIA station chief for the entire region during the time these deaths occurred. And he said unequivocally that Hussein was given the rap. The Iranians actually did that particular killing. It was not Hussein. Now, either the man was lying or mistaken, but it's hardly likely that either would occur. If you had read the interview as I did, it was a very well-spoken and measured statement by the man. So it is possible also that Hussein, among other things, having had to stand the absurdity of a kangaroo court, was charged with something he didn't do. That's not to say the guy is innocent of anything. We're just talking about the particular case. John, real quick.
Well, I will say this before the next ad, that with the death of Saddam Hussein, for whatever reason, we see the end of Iraq as a nation.
Well,
he was the last person who kept it together, and it will now break apart.
As he said, apparently, in that room when they killed him, he said, Iraq is nothing without me.
And unfortunately, just as Nazi Germany was nothing without Adolf Hitler, that's true. The kind of Iraq that he ruled, dark as it was. And the other things that relate to him as a chief candidate for Mabus have now come forth.
All right, very good. Be right back. John Hogue is here tonight. HogueProphecy.com is the website. John's been with us, I don't know how many years now, but doing his forecast for the coming year. And ladies and gentlemen, the man is rarely incorrect. In fact, I don't think you're ever incorrect. You're just not quite on the money sometimes. There's a difference.
Well, it's a it's some events. Certainly, I get things wrong, and this new bulletin that I'm going to show what I said last year, though, will show an 80% accuracy. I find it rather shocking that it was so accurate. Some of the things that happened in the article will probably did not happen in 2006, but definitely seem to be at the best delayed. The thing that I already wrote was that we would be seeing a number of, that Saddam Hussein would be dead by now, and that this would be a milestone in the beginning of the true civil war. I kept saying that over the years that Saddam Hussein's show monkey trial and things that were going on were just setting the stage for him to propound his last myth before dying, and that is to kind of do what Hitler did when he was caught for the Munich putsch back in the early 20s. He turned the show trial into a mockery of the current status quo, and gained Hitler did the love and interest of many mainstream German people. Saddam Hussein is in a similar position, even though he kind of followed Stalin as his role model, not Hitler. He has been using this trial with a lot of help from the hypocrisy and mediocrity of the U.S.-trained justice system in Iraq to show them as unable to govern themselves, that they need a strong man. That he was the strong man, and the Americans have, in their name as puppets, has martyred him. And there is some truth to that, just like some of the things Hitler said had truth to it, but to lead in general to an end which is not going to be positive for Iraq. This is a myth, and the incompetence of the Shia-ruled government, who could not resist temptation to take vengeance on Saddam Hussein, has now created him in something that cannot be shaken. He is now a myth of the Arab nationalist martyr, the Sunni leader martyr.
Well, he'll never be forgotten.
Exactly what they've given him his death wish.
Yeah.
The fools. And yeah. And to add to that, if any of you have seen the film taken by video, by a camera, a phone camera, of the actual execution, it is at least very clear to me that for the all Shia guards to be blurting out "Muqtada, Muqtada, Muqtada," and then Saddam Hussein in Arabic smiled and said, "Do you think this is showing your manhood?"
Right.
And then he said, "Do you think this is Arab courage? What you're doing?" And faced his death, no matter how bad he was, he faced it like a man and died with bravery, even though it does not, even bad people can be brave. The thing that's so intriguing about this to me as a Nostradamus scholar is this long, long time since I've been talking about Saddam Hussein in my books, there has been this other figure who takes revenge, makes this figure of Saddam repent. And there is a prophecy that I think, I mean, when I heard that they'd actually addressed Muqtada al-Sadr's name, he is the head of the Mahdi brigades, he is one of the key influencing players on the streets of Shia Iraq. He has his own militia, which I predict in this new surge of troops, you will see the battle of Sadr City coming in Baghdad. That will be the Stalingrad of Baghdad.
That I agree. I think that is ultimately Bush. I think that is Bush's aim,
yeah,
to go in there, and so he can't conquer the country. He's going to try to conquer the city, what's left of it,
and take down Muqtada al-Sadr,
exactly,
and his people. Now, there's a prophecy of Nostradamus, Quatrain 33 of Century 6 of his Book of Prophecy, which says, "His power finally through the bloody Alus." Alus is a French code, A-L-U-S, for La USA in French, the USA. So to read it is, "The power finally through the bloody USA, he will be unable to protect himself by sea. Saddam Hussein, in both Gulf Wars with America, could not protect himself from the Persian Gulf, where most of the forces came from. In both cases, they were landed mostly in the Persian Gulf. Mm-hmm. They came from the Persian Gulf. The next line says, between the two rivers, that's the Tigris and Euphrates, which is a geological main point of Iraq, he will fear the military hand, meaning from the sea, can't protect himself. Now, line four was fulfilled yesterday or day before during the execution. The black one will make the angry one repent of it. The angry one is a phrase that comes up in relation to Saddam Hussein in my interpretations over the years. And the black one is his nemesis. Hmm. Now, he's not a black man. He's not Negroid. He's the black one, and the black aspect is this play on words that Nostradamus does, which talks about the black robes of the Ayatollahs, the Shia clerics. Mm-hmm. I've been saying since my first book in 1987 that the source of the unraveling of the Middle East would come from Ayatollah Khomeini's revolution in Iran. I have been ridiculed often for this interpretation, especially after Ayatollah Khomeini died. But his
favorite color was black, too.
His successor, Khamenei, is still in power in Iran. He is the power behind Ahmadinejad, the president, who is just a puppet. He's the Dick Cheney to the Ahmadinejad, the puppet president of Iran. And this intention to spread across is going to happen because of Iraq breaking up, which I said could happen as far back as nearly 20 years ago. And now it's looking like this, with the death of Saddam Hussein, the black one is Muqtada al-Sadr, who got his revenge and made the angry one repent. And it's one of the last things Saddam heard was his name before being hung.
No accident that.
No.
Back in a couple minutes with John Hoag as we continue our year beginning conversation. John Hoag is here. We're doing our forecast for 2007. Well, certainly looking back over our shoulders with a great deal of interest, watching how this moves forward and through the divide, so to speak. Go ahead, John.
Well, we are entering a period where not one, but several candidates for Mabus, the third Antichrist of Nostradamus' prophecies, could be beyond the mortal coil, as it were. I predict that Osama bin Laden will not see the year out, that he is probably very close to death now. And you add to that Saddam Hussein's hanging, another candidate for Mabus, and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's death from missiles fired into his safe house in June of last year. We have three of the four major candidates who have succumbed, which means, as far as the prophecy is concerned, we now have to wait for what comes afterwards. If one or a composite of all three are the man Mabus, who is soon annihilated, who soon dies, and then there will come a terrible undoing or destruction of people and animals, a phrase that Nostradamus does not use any other place in his 36,000 words, so it's
wow.
A very specific phrase of him embracing the death of both animal and man from the same weapons or same whatever. He didn't say what.
Or but, organism.
But it is, in other prophecies, he talks about the next war being many man-made plagues would shower across the earth, of red and icy rains, something that looks like ice but isn't. It stains bodies red. When I look at the bodies in Halabja in Kurdistan, if you see the pictures of them, one of the few opportunities for us to see what exactly chemical weapons do. Many of the bodies are stained red, just like the prophecies of Nostradamus said they would be in these man-made plagues. So when I see a phrase like the destruction of people and animals, which were both killed by the gas, I'm thinking that we will know who Mabus will be when things really start escalating. There are two statements in the prophecies that tried to describe how long the war will last, the war of the third Antichrist. One states in the prophecy itself that when he is soon annihilated, 27 years his war will last. Now, that's an interesting phrase because if we count the year that Saddam Hussein became dictator of Iraq and to the year he was executed, it is exactly 27 years. And then one could then say, well, the war of the third Antichrist was what kind of Saddam Hussein was fighting all the time that he was dictator. Shortly, within a year of being dictator, he started the Gulf War with Iran, which lasted until 1988.
Was there a Mabus candidate who died shortly before Saddam Hussein took control of Iraq?
Abu Musab al-Zarqawi.
No, before, 27 years ago, like 28 years ago.
No.
Okay.
Nobody came up significant.
Forget the interruption. Go ahead. I just had to ask that.
And so, you know, with a few years or a year and a half respite, then there was the Gulf War. The Operation Desert Shield led to Operation Desert Storm, 90, 91. The long and protracted no-fly zone, kind of a low-grade war that
never
got a little
killing,
hotter.
Right?
Hmm?
Never stopped the killing. It didn't.
Yeah. There has been war either forward thrusting or in the background of almost every year Saddam Hussein's 27 years as dictator or living. But the problem is one can get caught in that and think, well, it's about Saddam Hussein and the war is over with his death. Yes, that is possible. You could say that. But then the prophecy then says a terrible destruction of people happened when he soon dies. And then there is another prophecy in the Epistle to Henry II, which is another big prophetic narrative of Nostradamus's, that says the war of the third Antichrist will last 25 years. So you have a 27-year, 25-year. So at the very least, even if you interpret it to mean Saddam Hussein and his 27 years of his own personal war against America, against his neighbors, there's going to be another quarter century of war after his death. So
it appears that Iran is in the crosshairs.
Well, Iran is the source of the potential unraveling of the Middle East, as I predicted, and therefore we're coming to a head with it, although I believe that extremists on the Judeo-Christian side of these... We have three apocalyptic religions that are all believing that this is the time.
All believing, and might I add, all...
working towards it.
Thank you.
And you have that in the White House as much as you have it in Tehran. You have it. You have Shias in Iraq who believe the Messiah, the Mahdi, is coming, the 12th Imam, as much as Sunnis believe this. You have a strong movement developing in Israel for the coming of the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah. And in all of this, you have people with rather, I would call, religiously fascist views on all sides, believing that their side has some kind of ubermensch, superhuman, we're the chosen people and everybody else are not, and we're going to lead the way, and if they don't come with us, we will burn our way to the truth and to God's great glory. This is being expressed by what I call Christianists, by Judeo-fascists, by Islamo-fascists on the three sides of this war, this anvil of Armageddon that they all want to slam their hammers on. And it is, Iraq is the battlefield. It is probably going to unleash a regional religious civil war between Sunni Arabs and, well, Sunni Muslims and Shia. I am very, very concerned that not the American president, but some precipitous act by Zionists will trigger a war, a preemptive strike on Iran, with a lot of good grounds to do it, by the way, I must add. There's just to step back from this, and remember, when I speak of Zionists, I'm not speaking of the Judeo race of Jewish people. I'm speaking, just like if I'm talking about Nazis, I'm not talking about all German people.
That's a distinction I've been trying to make for close to 10 years now, and people are beginning to catch on. It's a geopolitical movement which knows no boundaries, is beholden to no one, and engages in unlimited actions, both legal and illegal, to try to attain its goals.
Sounds like the Bush administration and Ahmadinejad in Iran as well.
There are many who would fit that profile.
What we have is a convergence of very intolerant and, I believe, very badly misinterpreted views of the founders of three great religions. And they have a, on all three sides, have a righteous surety that is psychotic.
It's arrogance. It's beyond arrogance. It's psychotic. Yeah,
it is. It's psychotic. Yeah. And it is a something I've been writing about for many years, what I call propaganda, a new word I coined in my book,
That's
Messiah.
Good. Yeah.
That it is a fever. A rush towards war, a rush towards an idea of this war has to happen, things have to get worse for our Messiah to save us from ourselves, that is being propounded by the extremists in three religions born from the very region that is going to go up in flames as soon as this year. But this war is long-lasting. And it's not all going to be over in one big violent crash. So I don't see the Bush administration actually launching a war with Iran. I don't see them needing to. The Israelis will do it, and then they will back the Israelis. To step back even further, I mean, the whole tone of this show tonight is sort of capturing what I would call that collective vibe that I'm sure you're all feeling, especially in the last year and a half, especially since the summer of 2005 onwards.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a cosmic source. It is literally a stellar sign of war. Leo, the constellation of fire and war, is always a sign of war when Saturn transits through it. And then Mars joins it, or joins Saturn in another fire sign.
And we're something, there.
Something for years I've been warning about. We've been there since 2005 with Saturn's transit in Leo. We are entering, by June, the final 10 degrees into September of this year, where everything comes to a head. So there is a statement that I've talked about on your show before about when Saturn and Mars are equally fiery, that's when this great war prepared by the West is unleashed on the Near East. There are three times, one that's already passed, one that we're in at this moment, and one in May, June of this year, later this year, where this happens astrologically. The last time it happened was in June, July of last year, 2006, and we, of course, had the Lebanese War, and finally the Civil War erupted in Iraq. It was a far worse war than what the news was focused on with the Israeli attacks of Hezbollah in Lebanon. That is the first campaign of this war. It's now in a truce, a smoldering, which we're going to see more and more as this war goes on. It's not going to be ongoing like the last World War. It's going to be violent month of stuff and then back off for half a year or a year. Stutters and starts.
Mm-hmm.
The next stutter start is now. In fact, it's happening in Iraq. It is coming unglued in Iraq. This big force that's going to come from America is too little too late. It is going to get bogged down even more.
Oh, yeah.
And this is during the second equally fiery passage of Mars and Saturn. The third comes in June and May of this year at the end of the Saturn transit, which means very much as likely an Iran war.
Okay. Very good, John. Stand by another hour to go with John Hoag. His website is hoagprophecy.com. And we will continue after the top of the hour break. See you on the other side. Talking with Nostradamus scholar and world authority, John Hoag, about what's coming up. And it's going to be, by all accounts, astrological. Nostradamus, others as well, have been predicting something very big, very catastrophic for a long time. All things would seem to be lined up now. It's almost now as if mass consciousness on the planet is so predisposed to a cataclysm of sorts, John, that mass consciousness could propel in its own way an unfolding of events to become self-fulfilling.
Yes, I would just redefine it as mass unconsciousness.
Thank you.
Consciousness...
well said, that's more correct.
There is a force. There is something I've been speaking about for decades based on fourth world prophecies of the native peoples of the world, who often shared the vision that there's a certain critical mass of people living unconsciously on the planet, thinking, feeling, living, acting more like machines than living people. They dream and think that they are living, thinking people with souls, but they actually are not. And there's a huge mass of these people that the Earth has never seen before. And at a certain point, a critical mass of unconscious thought starts to trigger a kind of collective, a short era of collective madness.
Now, this is fascinating. Go ahead. You've said several interesting things. Go ahead.
The time generally that's been pinpointed in normal time that we'd start seeing the signs of this was around 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And what would then happen is that people would just, and you see parallels to this idea in many biblical prophecies as well, where people just act, the kings, the leaders, the captains and the kings and the people all do and act irrationally and seem to be unaware of it, as if they're sleepwalking. And this is kind of a precursor to an evolutionary crisis that's coming, is that, just to give you an example, there are things that George W. Bush has said in the role of President of the United States that if he had said it even 15 years ago as
right.
President of the United States, they would have locked him up. But we just nod and blink and go on. And that is, and anyone who kind of just nods and blinks and just sort of goes, oh, well, okay, that's also a passive participation in the madness that is overtaking the modern world. Now, the thing about madness and about having a nervous breakdown, that's the other way of putting it, is the world is reaching a point where the sum total of all this collective unconscious behavior is creating a meltdown, not just in our own beings, but also a lot of prophets will say that the end of great ages are always marked by not only the meltdown of civilizations where thousands of years of what has been built is destroyed by kind of mass hysteria. But also you see more earthquakes, tidal waves, climate change. All of this is also part of it because we live in a symbiosis. We live, no man or being or thing is an island unto itself. The cosmos, the sun, the universe, it's all somehow interconnected.
So then we have the question of chicken and the egg. Is it the mass unconscious that is driving some of these terrible earth changes, or vice versa, or both?
It is, in part, influence. They influence each other.
It has to.
In the future, when we learn in 100 years or so to measure and thought, because thought is a thing, it's a very subtle radio signal.
We're getting close to it now, my friend.
We are, but soon in the future, in the distant future, when we're able to actually monitor soul passage and thought passage, people will understand in that time, will have an objective evidence in that time of exactly what drove us crazy in the 21st century, 20th and 21st centuries. And it's what is... I'm really sorry. I want to apologize to everyone tonight on how, in a string of dire shows that I've done, this sounds probably one of the most dire in energy and content. But I'd like to try to pluck something positive from this, and that is that if the world goes mad, then it triggers in individuals a desire to go sane. And so, you know, action always has response or reaction. So what is also happening in our times, although it's still in a minority of people, but still a significant minority, larger than perhaps the whole population of the Earth for most of its history of human history, are people who, in this greater madness, are being kind of rubbed by the friction of this madness to find their sanity, to find something that is not of thought, that is a consciousness, a superconsciousness that is not so easily sent off like sheep in a mob into an abyss. In a way, it's heretical. You know, the word heretic comes from sheep herder's terms of the black sheep that decides not to be with the rest of the mob of sheep.
Sure.
Doesn't want to be a lemming going over the cliff, but goes its own way.
Look and how the internet, John, is impacting all the things you're talking about. It is accelerating, exacerbating, and geometrically progressing all of them. Now, if people happen to be of a lower vibrational energy, shall we say, and they enjoy porn, crime, death, destruction, the internet is not only a voyeur's delight, a treasury, but it is also a propelling influence, which further can absolutely project and allow to grow, to metastasize those very kinds of dark energetic patterns throughout even greater numbers of people by the minute. That's what we're faced with. Now, the opposite can be said about the good things that are on the internet, but by and large, with pornography being the number one website destination of choice online, and all the links thereof, we don't have to go too far down the road to understand what you, John Hogue, are saying about a collective unconscious madness. The potential thereof is huge.
So the thing that people will see more and more, those who have discovered the madness in themselves and see it around them in their day-to-day life, are going to then start to ask the question, is this madness me? Am I my thoughts? Am I my personality? Am I, if I had been born in Saudi Arabia, would I not be a Wahhabi fighting with Al-Qaeda rather than a Marine fighting against Al-Qaeda in Iraq? Because I was born a Marine in God, apple
right.
pie, America.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to need, and actually the crisis of this insanity is going to force a significant number of people to seek an answer to why we're going mad. And the thing is that essentially we're coming to the end of a very long cycle, 25, 26,000 year cycle, of the human mind as it is ruled by the personal egoic nature
mm-hmm.
that is now coming derailed.
How about the id?
Well, the id is the subconscious,
mm-hmm.
And it's subconscious because there's not an awareness of it. And as the great mystics of the East have taught us, one can, through meditation, through the science of self-observation, become aware of the mind, its subconscious and conscious natures. And by becoming aware of it, the theory says, one mm-hmm. gains a distance from the madness.
Hmm. Well, interesting. Let me ask you another thing you mentioned, which I heard many, many years ago, and I used to talk a little bit about it to people, and I was immediately jumped on and called me elitist and all the rest of it. When I said to some that it has been proposed that there are so many people on the planet now that some of them, a certain substantial proportion of them, actually are soulless. In the traditional sense of the word. That doesn't mean they're not good people or bad people, but it had been proposed by I forget whom years and years ago that there were some people on the planet, a growing number, who were soulless. And you suggested that in some kind of terminology a few
yes.
minutes ago, and I want to go back to that if I can, because it's very
yes.
interesting, and it does make sense when you think about it.
Well, I asked the audience, I'm sure we've all had this experience. You're walking in a great mass of humanity in downtown, or you're at a football game or something, and isn't there sometimes for some of you a feeling that you look around yourself and you feel like you're in a world of zombies or
strangers?
Ghosts.
Yes,
people.
We don't know. Yes, stranger yeah. in a strange land syndrome.
Yes, and people who have this potential to awaken from this coming madness. Those people who have the seed of the new humanity that so many prophecies that I talk about in my books talk about are people who do feel like they're strangers in a strange land. In fact, as they become more centered in their own truth,
right.
the world beyond them seems more crazy. And it's because their souls, which were seeds, most people have souls, but their seed form. A seed is dead, even though it has the potential of a great tree. It has to be given the right water and soil to grow. The vast majority of the human race have souls, but they're seeds, therefore they never grow. That's
really?
The answer to this zombie field. So the question is, you seed out there, whoever I'm talking to, find the right soil, find the right water, and flower.
Very well said, John. And now I understand more clearly the explanation to that person who many years ago wrote about this issue, that not everyone walking the planet anymore has souls. There are too many of them, so it is in a seed form. Very well said, very profound. Back in just a few minutes with John Ho. All of you, John Hogue and yours truly, Jeff Rentz. Hope you're able to visit Rentz.com. Stop by any time. We have news going up around the clock 7 days a week for you. Talking about some very, very profound things. And for those of you out there who are sneering and laughing and saying, what do you mean not everyone has souls? Well, everyone does have a soul, but they are certainly not necessarily on equal footing, as John termed it, seed stage in many cases. That would answer this dead feeling that that I perceive, John, when I'm out amongst a lot of people. They are moving, they're talking, walking, laughing, and all the rest of it, but there's something missing. I don't know what it is, and I am not an elitist. I just felt a coldness, an emptiness, a vacuum, as it were, that I was walking through a surreal kind of living motion picture.
That's right. It's not elitist, it's awareist. It's awareist. It is becoming aware. It's the first drop of the right water on the dry husk of a seed in us. The vast majority of people that one sees are as if dead. Because look at a seed. Compared to the great oak, the seed of an oak looks like a piece of wooden rock.
Right.
And it's lifeless. It appears dead, even though that dead-looking, inanimate seed has within its mystery the entire oak tree. And out of that oak tree, the ability to make an infinite number of seeds in a long life as an oak tree. So there is in every atomically small and seemingly dead seed of soul an infinite potential for creativity, for love, for intelligence, for flowering. And every human being has this.
And yet when we watch society, and Western society in particular, no, let's not forget the Chinese, the mass mind control over there, which seeks to subvert that kind of growth, that kind of individual flowering or blossoming, one begins to really worry about the future, because young people especially, and I watch them, you watch them, many of you listening watch them, maybe you have them as children and worry about them all the time, are growing up in a world virtually devoid of substance. It is all style, all glitter, all surface. It's a mask, and it's very, very unsettling to watch.
And it's all about to collapse right before their eyes. It's all going to collapse, and that's good, even though it's going to be uncomfortable and painful. But the people, the artificial life cannot be sustained by loading on another billion people every 11 years. It cannot be sustained when vast tracts of Canadian ice shelves that have never seen the water start crashing into the water, and eventually over the next 20 to 30 years lift the oceans by a dozen feet and drown every port and harbor and 90% of the rice fields of Asia. These things that we are now so enamored with, hypnotized by, addicted to, cannot be sustained in the next 20 years as they are.
Pick up, I was sitting waiting on those, a stack of magazines on a table, and I picked up one, I don't know, it was People or Us or one of these celebrity-style pop culture things, and I actually thumbed through it cover to cover. And I felt very empty after that experience, John. I felt very sad for the young people who have these as role models, for God's sakes. This whole inane, mindless, vapid, dirty, empty, vile culture called celebrity, which they yearn for, they strive for. Everyone wants to be a celebrity, and they craft their own personalities from a myriad selection of parts out there amongst the pop culture. They'll take a piece here and a piece there, and that's their mask, that's their personality. They have never, and how do you wake up an intellect, we've got to wake them up, how do you wake up an intellect that is dead or was stillborn or has never been allowed to grow?
First off, the one of the subtleties of the insanity that overtakes us, a couple things I need to say, because it's good points that you've placed there. First, before I answer the one, I have to answer one before it.
And yeah, running close on time, so mark those down and we'll come back to them.
I'm going to do one before the ad,
okay.
And then we'll follow with it afterwards.
Very good.
This cult of celebrity, this madness drawing towards celebrity, is a new mask on an old problem. Before the information age and TV age, the same madness had another face. It was called nationalism. The same madness before that had another face, crusaderism, or this or that. What I'm simply saying is, we often mistake the masks of the same problem. In our entire history, there's really not much different, I would pose to you, with people 50,000 years ago and people today, except that we have more distractions to play our madness in, our primitiveness in. The fact that there are more of us has magnified the stupidity that has always been running history, even when people had at least more noble illusions to follow. Now they have less noble illusions, but an illusion is an illusion. And whether earlier societies behaved better and were more civil with each other, it was a good illusion. Now we've come to the other pendulum, the bad illusion, but it's still illusion. It's still a false perception of the reality, and only handfuls of people have awakened from this: a Christ, a Muhammad, a Buddha, a Rabia. So that's the first part of the question.
Okay, very good.
And then we'll go further.
All right, we'll do that in just a couple minutes as we continue with John Hogue, and all of you good people, thanks for being there. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Continue. The madness, of course, continues. Everywhere you look, the Iraqi puppet regime announces it's going to launch an investigation into the execution of Saddam Hussein to find out how a cell phone camera got in there. Golly gee. Pat Robertson, meanwhile, tells us all that God has told him there's going to be a mass killing of Americans by a terror attack in late 2007. Headlines to think about. All right, John,
Well,
it's like Saturday Night Live, but worse.
Yeah, more like 2008 for the latter prediction. To answer what you said before, the second part, if you were saying, as I understood it, that you know, with this message, with this complete soulless celebrity fixation that young people have,
the religion is hedonism.
And it's ironic because a true hedonist, like Epicurus, the great philosopher, they lived totally. Most people who think they're hedonists are actually quite unconscious in how much they drink and eat and smoke and
correct.
Make love and do all these things. A true hedonist is actually like a Zorba the Greek, somebody who is, or like Epicurus, somebody who will put their full attention to the life sensate.
Well, it's convenient greed now is what it is.
Yeah. But most people are desensitized, and they're in the syndrome now of, you know, I was watching Forbidden Planet had a new special edition, and they had all these trailers for science fiction films of the 1950s, and you know, at that time these trailers were for that era trying to get people aroused to see a movie with hyperbole and excitement and all that, and as I was watching it I was thinking, my God, these are so tame compared to the kind of assault of movie promos for action movies.
Oh yeah,
now
amazing. Well, the special effects, they've just gone way over the top.
If you had sent something back in time to those days to show us this, the people would be running out of the theater screaming.
They would. If they had sat in a theater and seen 10 trailers of fast action movies today, they would have gone out ill if they'd made it through them.
But look around you in your theater, all you people listening to this show, and see how many people just look on like zombies at this.
And
this
laugh when they're told to, John.
Yeah.
On cue, every time, no matter if it's funny or not.
Now, when faced with this stirring awareness in us of the vast majority of us who are completely zombie-like, it is natural to think, what can we do to wake up our kids, the new generations that seem to be more and more profoundly desensitized than the last, when you consider that all the kids who plug into MP3 and the Steve Jobs iPods in another 10 years are going to have hearing that's even worse than a 70-year-old.
Yeah, they walk by you and you can hear it 15 feet away and you wonder, what the heck's wrong with this kid?
What kind of world of the deaf are we about to enter in another 10 years? Now, the problem with all of this is it can be very disheartening because of one simple reason, and I think it's very important to talk about this very revolutionary turn of perception that a passive consciousness and meditation has helped me at least see, and I want to share it with everyone, is that one of the most fundamental problems in the attempt over history to make the world better seems to me to be that we step in our first step away from the problem. It's a very noble step, We step towards those who are in trouble, and we try to help them. We try to enlighten them. But we, as we step out to help the people who are seeds to flower, we forget that we're not taking care of our own flowering. If it would be better than to go out and help people see the light, why not become the light yourself, and then they'll see it?
Yeah, great.
And it's a revolutionary shift, and it's so against the programming which is in us to sabotage this thing, is that there's not power in the collective action. There is actually true power of change for the better in the individual transformation. And that is a hard one because it goes against the grain of all of our conditioning. In fact, the conditioning has been put in us to prevent us becoming Christ
everyone
or Buddha.
Is, right.
We are trained to be Christians or Buddhists. You're not going to be your own Muhammad going up on the mountain to see Jibril the angel. You're going to be told about it in a madrasa where you're hypnotized, davening all day, memorizing words you don't even understand. This is the what is called religion in our current existence is actually irreligious in my view.
No, it's entrainment. It's completely reactive. There's nothing proactive or creative about it that I can see.
And so the solution, ironically, is opposite from the way we do it. Obviously, that's got to be the case because at least it's worth trying because we have always reached out to help and improve the world. And look at the world; it's not getting better. It might get a little better for a while, then it atrophies into something else. There's got to be something fundamentally wrong with this approach. And if the approach has been taught to us by our societies, since those societies seem to be in the core fundamentally wrong, then don't use those teachings. The thing is that one has to find that spark that opens the seed of one's own soul and move with it in its unique intelligence. And when that happens, through techniques of awareness, through living, therefore, a different life, you will attract, with this light of light, life of light, you will attract fellow travelers. There are millions, hundreds of millions of people who have the ability to be conscious, loving, fully lit up beings in the light of their potentials, flowering seeds of humanity. And there's a theory in the spiritual world that states that quantity is the power of unconsciousness, but quality, in the opposite, is the power of consciousness. That means one man like a Buddha can light the lights of millions of people. One man like Jesus or Muhammad can light the lights of millions and millions of people. You could count on one hand a handful of mystics who have altered the course of our evolution of enlightenment and spiritual peace. You know, Krishna, Buddha, Muhammad, Jesus, and Socrates, and a few others. And these people had a huge impact, but they all were individuals. They all sought the truth. They did not, none of them obediently, mechanically obeyed the religion of their time. Did Jesus obey the Pharisees? Did Muhammad obey the animists of the Arab culture? Did Buddha bow down mindlessly to the Brahmins, whatever they said was true? No, they rebelled against these people. They were considered cult leaders, brigands, and it's that rebellion that gave us the new steps in consciousness that we even have today. That has to happen for every individual. And it's not a question whether other individuals get it or not. That's the other thing is, if I don't get it, I am a majority of one. If I don't get it, then my whole majority of being is wrong. Who cares if you get it or somebody else gets it? Mm. I must get it.
Mm. Right, all right. Stand by, we'll pause and be right back.
We'll be right back.
we return with all of you and John Hoag. All right, my friend, we have one segment to go here.
Well, just in brief, during the ad, I got a very lovely, a lot of people are flooding in with their emails as I'm dancing around here in my office, looking at the screen, talking to you all, and Patricia sends hope that my cracking voice is not a sign that I'm losing hope.
No, it's your internet speaker is what.
Yeah, it's more, my cracking voice is more from the fact that I've been so busy over the last 3 weeks preparing for all of you a completely new and revamped HopeProphecy.com. And on
I don't hear any cracking voice.
No, well, she did. I heard myself crack a few times. And so I've been putting in a lot of hours into that because I'm very excited to have this thing up and running by mid-January. And in it will be my first e-book, which I'm kind of moving beyond the physical publishing world into cyberspace for my books.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hope everybody's listening will come in and visit and see what's available, as well as my free Hoag Prophecy Bulletin, which will remain free. It'll keep you up to date of everything that's going on as it relates to my interpretations of Nostradamus and prophecy and current events. So anyway, with that said, thanks everybody out there who thinks that I need to rest. The other thing that I would add is oftentimes people say, well, shouldn't there be hope? You need more hope, or I want more hope, or can you say something that's comforting? And I just want to simply say that I very positively and with great celebration say this, abandon all hope. Because when you abandon hope, you have also abandoned hopelessness. When you abandon fear, when you abandon being safe, you've also abandoned fear.
Mm-hmm.
When you start living a life that's in security rather than insecurity, when you start living a life through a conscious path, you become not insignificant, but inwardly significant. And so these feelings, this feeling of comfort is also, why seek comfort? Why not, why not celebrate the fact that we're living in an uncomfortable time? Why not turn it into a positive? Why not be challenged by it? Why not take it in a positive way that things are kind of scary? Yes, they are scary. There's no denying that. But the unpredictable future is kind of exciting, too. But one thing for sure, comfort and holding on to hope are very subtle ways of stopping the process of breaking through the shell of a lifeless seed. They have to be broken, these things, sometimes, to see something much bigger, something that is freer and more transcendent than hope or comfort or safety and security, or even insecurity and fear and all these things. These are little things. There's something in us that I've come more in contact as the times get more strange and impactful for all our lives, is this safe center, this what Osho used to call the Noah's Ark of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
There's no ark that's going to save us from the floods that are coming.
Mm-hmm.
There's no world we can go to at this stage of our technological advancement. We can't get to another world to start exploiting it again like we exploited new worlds and continents on this planet.
We're not deserving or ready.
Yeah. And so we've got to clean up our act here and now, and we will. We will, because things will get that bad that will make us have to do it. It's sort. I like to think of the analogy of everybody in the last Summer Olympics were very concerned that the Greeks in Athens for the Athens Olympics were not going to get the buildings ready for the great Olympic celebrations and sports events. And they just nodded, the mayor of Athens, saying, look, you've got to understand us, Greeks. We only when it's really on us and it scares us into action, we just get it all done because it gives us the adrenaline to do it. And that's just the way we do things. Don't worry, it'll all get done.
That's not province of just the Greeks either. That's the way people
no.
tend to work.
It was just the excuse was it was used that way. And,
right.
and what happened was that obviously on the verge of a disaster, the people gathered, used that energy and turned it around, and they got the Olympics ready, and it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happened, because first I was a bit skeptical when they were saying that, the Greek leaders, and then when it turned out to be a very nice Olympics, it got me wondering. I was saying, aren't we as a whole people, Greeks, Russians, Americans, Iraqis, everybody, aren't we as a human race kind of being pushed into a similar situation where we're just going to have to turn it around because there's going to be this collective human adrenaline rush caused by the dangers, the deadline.
Perhaps it'll be an environmental catastrophe, a war, a bacteria, a virus, I don't know. But name one globalist or international corporation which mines the planet's skin, as it were, for its profits, which has slowed down in any way, shape, or form, or exhibited any kind of intelligence and conservatism regarding the rape of the planet. None of them have. In fact, they're accelerating every step of the way. So it's going to eventually crash.
Yes.
And at that point, is what John is saying, humanity will either stand up and rise to its potential and sweep this floor clean and rearrange everything and fix it, or we're gone.
And it can be fixed in small steps. There are many things that Al Gore in his Inconvenient Truth movie has done to make people aware of very simple things that they can do that can help the planet. You can support Toyota by their resurrecting of the electric car that GM destroyed. The Japanese are building one.
Yeah.
Buy one and tell GM that if they don't start making them, it's bad for business. You see, we have to, for the materialists, the so-called, I don't call them capitalists, I call them the new aristocratists of CEO class, who behave a lot like French aristocracy did, where they just hoarded their wealth, and they didn't give it back to the people, and they just didn't even care, and then one day they found themselves in the guillotine. The history repeats itself, and the people who are in this kind of CEO-ist point of view,
mm-hmm.
which is very uncapitalistic, by the way. A capitalist invests his money and profits into the market. A capitalist understands that impoverishing his market is stupid. That
well, they don't kill the golden goose.
Yeah, you don't kill the golden goose. So this isn't capitalism that's going on right now in America. It's something else.
Yeah.
And the way...
It's a lusting greed, the likes of which the planet has never seen, and all greased and abetted by a technology that has never been seen before on the planet, at least that we know about.
So the way that people can creatively change this is don't expect people of this ilk to change, but change the game. If you don't buy the products, if you convince them through your actions that it's bad business to be Earth-unfriendly, then they're not going to change and be better for the Earth because they love the Earth. They want your business.
Yeah.
So it's up to you people to make them change their business model by how you buy and act. Don't be their stooges. You make them your stooges. That's one way. There's many ways.
Sure, but voting with the dollar is really the only thing that these companies and corporations are going to listen to. They talk, they make small little public relations jabs here and there about how they're going to do this and that. But when it comes down right to the bottom line, it's the bottom line every time. And when their dollars begin to dry up, they'll change. They're not going to listen to 8,000 different demonstrations and papers and studies, and it doesn't matter. They know. They already know. But as long as they can keep doing business the way they're doing it, what was it, Bill Ford, he retired recently. He just gave it up.
Yeah.
When he took over Ford, I think it was 5 years ago, he said small cars, more efficient electric cars, all the things that that you and I, and I think most of our listeners, would like. You know what? It didn't work. Ford continued losing money, and they had to now go back to their gas-guzzling motif to survive. They're already bankrupt anyhow, but yeah, the people are still not demanding it, John. You're right.
Yeah, but the political will then is created by disasters that are coming. When your gas is $10 a gallon because of an idiotic war with Iran, maybe as soon as this year, maybe as soon as March or May, June of this year, and suddenly the whole global oil situation is in doubt, the whole world after this little war is going to have to think about, you know what, it just doesn't, I'm just tired of having to rely on my energy from an area that is just a sinkhole, a tar pit,
right,
for my men and women in my armed forces, for mm-hmm. my treasury, for my treasures. Wake up, America. I think 2007, 2008, with the disasters that are going to come from the military disasters of this president and some of the further disasters in our climate, are a very good thing. It will make you wake up, America, because that's really the problem. It's you, America. It's not your government. It's not what's going on in the Middle East. It's decisions we have made as citizens, irrespective of our constitutional obligation, that is causing this problem.
Well, most Americans, John, can't even walk out in the street anymore and do anything about protesting. They just sit home and push that remote and change the channel.
Protesting in the streets
We understand that it's a cul-de-sac. Nonetheless, it at least shows an activist population, which we don't have now.
Well, what will happen is when it's very clear that this, and it's going to come starting this year and next year, when it's clear that we can't sustain our lifestyle the way we're doing, there will then be the political will, and then there will be people who will step in to lead that will. But right now, we're just on the verge of it. It's coming this year.
All right. So, better fasten our seatbelts, eh?
Yes.
Okay.
It's going to be a bumpy ride, but it's a great journey.
Thank you, John. Thanks for being here. Always a pleasure, my friend, and let's have you back fairly soon rather than not so soon.
Yes, I love to talk about some of my new e-books next
Will
time.
Do. Okay, John.
Okey-doke.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
John Hoag, HoagProphecy.com. Now, lots to think about there. As always, with that man, he is a remarkable scholar and an amazing mind. We'll be back in 21 hours.